Our next speaker is the new Shadow Secretary of State for Northern Ireland. He's been the Member of Parliament for Bury South since Labour's landslide in 1997, and he served as a Minister of State for a wide variety of portfolios, such as care, international development, and also foreign affairs. He became the Shadow Secretary of State for Northern Ireland in October last year, and he's attending his first Alliance Party conference since taking up that position. I'm pleased to introduce you to Ivan Lewis, Member of Parliament.
Thank you very much, Billy. Can I begin by saying it's a tremendous honour to have been asked to address your conference here today. This is the fifth Northern Ireland Party conference I've attended since being appointed to the role of Shadow Secretary of State only in October. And there is one common denominator which binds together each of these conferences: great speeches, dynamic political debate, memorable slogans, maybe. But the common denominator I'm referring to is yet another photo opportunity with Glyn Roberts. Some of you will be aware of that. I want to pay tribute to, first of all, David Ford. He's doing an incredibly difficult job, and everyone you speak to and everywhere you go, whatever their political affiliations, speaks incredibly highly of the job he's doing as Justice Minister in Northern Ireland. And that is a great tribute to his leadership, but also, I think, to his integrity and sense of fairness and justice. I also want to use this opportunity to pay tribute to Naomi Long. Her courage, her strength of character is remarkable. And I want to send a very clear message here today. Violence or intimidation against any elected representative is an attack on all elected representatives. And it's an attack on democracy itself. And that is why, when these things happen, I want to see the volume turned up in terms of all politicians in Northern Ireland saying this is not acceptable in our democracy. That would be a symbol of true progress in Northern Ireland. When I was appointed to this role by Ed Miliband 5 months ago, I said I would listen, learn, and then lead on issues where, even from opposition and in the context of devolution, I believe we can make a difference. Labour has a special stake in a stable and peaceful future for Northern Ireland because of our legacy, but also a great sense of ongoing responsibility about now and in the future. So today I want to primarily share with you what I've learned so far. But firstly, a little bit about my political story. I was elected to the UK Parliament in 1997, as has been said, at the very tender age of 30. I had jet black hair. I'm proud to represent the constituency where I was born, raised, and have lived all of my life, Bury South, a constituency just near to the centre of Manchester. I had the privilege of serving in the Blair and Brown governments as a minister for 9 years. I served in a number of departments: education, the Treasury, health, international development, and the Foreign Office. And since going into opposition, I've served in Ed Miliband's shadow cabinet, firstly at DCMS, then again back to the Department for International Development, and now Northern Ireland. For me, politics is a vocation, not a career. And I always believed it's not the title you hold, but the difference that you make that really matters. Unlike many of my contemporaries, I never went to university. Instead, at the age of 19, along with a group of friends in Manchester, I set up a charity to support people with learning disabilities and mental health problems. I spent the next 11 years working in the voluntary sector and also served as a local councillor for 8 years. These formative experiences shaped my passion for social justice and realisation that, for all its imperfections and constraints, democratic politics is the best means by which to achieve progressive change. I believe that as passionately today as I did when I was first elected to my local council 23 years ago. So what have I learned since October, since taking on this role? Well, firstly, let me deal with recent events. The implications of the judgment in the John Downey case will reverberate for some time. Some have suggested that the UK government, and more specifically my party, should recant or apologise for the introduction of the so-called on-the-run administrative scheme. I'm afraid I can't accept this, despite the understandable anger some have expressed. It would be a failure of leadership and integrity to be retrospectively selective about key elements of a historic peace process which ended 30 years of violence and terror. Peace processes, by their nature, are never perfect or easy. They require all participants to take a deep breath, swallow hard, and not allow any moment or issue to circumvent the big prize of an end to violence and a new beginning. That is why people like Tony Blair, Mo Mollem, and Jonathan Powell did what they did. And I'm proud that they did so in terms of that overall peace process under the banner of a Labour government. It is what successive Irish government leaders did, and why John Major deserves credit for his role in laying the foundations for the peace process. David Cameron was right the other week when he said it would be inappropriate to unpick any or all of the specific elements of the peace process when announcing the inquiry which we fully support into the On the Run scheme. Perhaps most of all, it's the Northern Ireland politicians who risked their lives, challenged their supporters, and in some cases put the price of peace ahead of their own party's short-term interests, who deserve our eternal respect. However, and it's an important however, in defending the peace process, we owe the families of the victims of the Hyde Park bombings both answers and an unequivocal apology for the dreadful error in the Downey case. This has once again accentuated the pain for those families, which never goes away and reduces the likelihood of them ever getting truth or justice. But we should also reflect on the crass insensitivity of those who chose to focus on the perceived wrong that Mr. Downey suffered. Is it any wonder people feel angry when the rights of an individual who is innocent, yes, until proven guilty, but who faced sufficient evidence to justify his arrest, appear to be more important than the soldiers brutally murdered on that day? It's similar to the anger people rightly feel when some seek to claim equivalence between a Republican or Loyalist paramilitary bomber killed in the course of an attempted bombing and a civilian or soldier killed by one of their attacks. Of course, the families of all concerned deserve the support of services established specifically to support victims of the trouble in Northern Ireland. But there should be no attempt to suggest moral equivalence between those who lose their lives in these very different circumstances. I don't agree that peace would be best served now and in the future by denying victims' families any right to seek answers and accountability for the loss of loved ones. Whether those concerned are the vast majority who were killed by IRA or Loyalist paramilitaries, or others who are alleged to have been killed unlawfully by military personnel, supposedly drawing a line with an across-the-board amnesty would do nothing, in my view, to heal wounds or help create a better environment for reconciliation. Through being denied due process, the families of the Hyde Park victims are far less likely to get either the truth or justice that they deserve. That is the worst element of an appalling error which the Police Service of Northern Ireland have rightly apologised for. It's important that the reason for this error is established, but also that the inquiry provides independent confirmation that no amnesty was being applied overtly or covertly. The present government has confirmed this to be the case, as have political colleagues who have had a central role in the establishment and the operation of the scheme. Of course, I have every confidence in these assurances, but public confidence requires this to be subject to independent examination by the inquiry. Can I also say that the UK government was right to apologise to David Ford and Peter Robinson for keeping them in the dark about the on-the-run letters which were sent post the devolution of policing and justice. This was a serious breach of trust and entirely unacceptable. The judge-led and select committee inquiries must be allowed to do their work. However, I disagree with those who argue very strongly that the all-party talks on the HAS recommendations dealing with flags, parades in the past should somehow be put on hold. It should serve actually to have the opposite effect on all political parties involved. Peace, stability and power sharing are at their most fragile for many years. I don't need to tell this audience that. When tested by events such as contentious parades, flag-flying decisions, or revelations from the past, sections of Northern Ireland society are regrettably prone to default to the old tribal sectarian divides. This, coupled with a continued political vacuum, will only give succour to extremists on all sides and exacerbate real and significant security concerns. So my challenge to Northern Ireland's political leaders is to confound conventional wisdom and reach an agreement on parades in the past as soon as is practically possible. The forthcoming local and European elections should be a platform for politicians to face the electorate with self-confidence that courageous political leadership will be attractive to the silent majority of voters who want their politicians to settle issues such as parades, the past, and flags. They yearn for a normal politics, which focuses on jobs, investment, the cost of living crisis, and the future of public services. Those who shout the loudest frequently do not represent the will of the people. Some will claim that no agreement on the past can be made prior to the judge-led inquiry reporting. I don't necessarily see that as being the case. Any agreement on the past will have to be accompanied by a resolution on parades and a process to deal with flags and symbols. Surely it cannot be in the public interest for this year's marching season to begin with the issues which caused so much tension last year and continue to be a source of disruption unresolved. Ultimately, of course, it's for Northern Ireland's political leaders to decide on the timing of and nature of any agreement. But with three successive years of elections ahead, there will be no easy time to make the tough choices and painful compromises, which frankly are unavoidable. So what else have I learned during my brief tenure in this job? Well, first of all, that Northern Ireland is a much better place than it was 15 years ago. And frankly, if people in Northern Ireland cannot celebrate that progress, who else can? This is a peace process which is lauded around the world, but people are very grudging about often here in Northern Ireland. We must always remember the progress. And if you talk to the younger generation particularly, who are not benchmarking today against the Troubles, many of them don't remember the height of the Troubles. Is it any wonder that they often ask questions about what that progress means? So it is important to contextualise Northern Ireland today in terms of the progress that's been made, whilst keeping a, as David Ford said in his speech, while keeping a very strong focus, most importantly, on the future. We also need to recognise, I've learnt, that stability and peace is fragile, particularly in Belfast. There is the serious dissident Republican threat, which we cannot ignore, nor should we minimise. There is a great deal of alienation in working class communities, where you have a lethal cocktail of poor educational attainment, worklessness, and in some cases a growing sense of loss of identity. There is, if we're honest, patchy reconciliation. David pointed out to the reduction in peace walls, but he has been working tirelessly to see a further change in that situation. When you come as an outsider and you see that number of peace walls, it is quite a shocking, powerful imagery. There's also, I think, the challenge of making reality of parity of esteem. Parity of esteem was at the heart of the Good Friday Agreement. And the question that one has to ask is, has enough progress been made? Is enough progress being made to achieve that fine, high-minded objective? I've also learnt about the traumatising impact of violence and of living in the fear of violence, which is often passed from one generation to the next. I think outsiders sometimes maybe looked at the Troubles, looked at the statistics, and didn't see behind those statistics the human realities. And so many people lived with the fear of violence, the reality of violence, and that has passed from one generation to the next, which is why I do feel strongly, as part of dealing with the past, but also very much the future, there needs to be universal, comprehensive, high-quality mental health services in Northern Ireland, perhaps more so than anywhere else in the United Kingdom. Then there are the economic and social challenges. It seems to me they are the breeding ground which the extremists will seek always to capitalise upon. Youth unemployment, which is higher than anywhere else in the UK. Welfare dependency, which, as I've said, passes from one generation to the next. Insufficient focus on enterprise, the development of the private sector, and an overdependence, therefore, on public sector jobs. The impact of welfare reform disproportionate on Northern Ireland because of some of the reasons that I have referred to. Of course there is a need for welfare change, and of course there is a need for reform. But there are elements of this Conservative-led government in Westminster's reforms that we as a party cannot accept. For example, the pernicious bedroom tax. And yet here in Northern Ireland, it's a kind of a take-it-or-leave-it offer in terms of the requirement to implement welfare reform. Yes to welfare reform, but not to every element of the welfare reform that the current government would like to impose. There is also a similar cost of living crisis in Northern Ireland as there is in the rest of the UK. Wages frozen, cost of living continuing to rise, and people in their everyday lives struggling to pay the bills, to do the right thing, to keep their families going. And we have to, I think, be sensitive to that as politicians, that disparity sometimes between headline figures. Of course we welcome the fact that growth is back in the economy, that unemployment is going down. We should welcome that. We should celebrate that. But we must also recognise that for the vast majority of people and families in Northern Ireland and elsewhere, they are not seeing any change to their everyday lives. What else have I learned? Well, there's the young person's exodus from Northern Ireland. Too many young, bright people leave Northern Ireland and don't come back. And I think there is a real challenge in terms of the kind of society that Northern Ireland seeks to build, as, of course, not denying young people the opportunity to travel, to move away for a while, but also wanting those young people to come back. If you look at conflict settings around the world, the ones that often have the most success are the ones who can attract diaspora back to be part of rebuilding their societies. And therefore, bringing back the young people of Northern Ireland, many of them to Northern Ireland, should be an objective that is very, very important. Then I think there's the issue of political leadership. And let's be honest, there are people trying to do very difficult things in difficult circumstances. I've already paid tribute to David Ford and to Naomi Long for what they're trying to do, often in very challenging circumstances. But disillusionment with the political class is widespread. And my challenge here is that the consequences of that disillusionment are worse potentially in Northern Ireland than they are elsewhere. So it's not a problem which is confined to Northern Ireland, but because of the past, because of the sectarian divide, because of the opportunity for extremists and paramilitary organisations to exploit that disillusionment, it's crucially important that we have not only strong and brave and courage and visionary political leadership now, but that you grow the next generation of political leaders too. And I think what I'm trying to say is there is a difference between good leadership and great leadership. And the way I try and articulate that is good leaders can mobilise and motivate their own base of support. They can deliver on the bread and butter issues that matter to people. But great leaders are the ones that are willing sometimes to say very difficult things to their own constituencies and are also willing to stand sometimes in the shoes of their former foes. That's what great leadership is sometimes about. It's not pandering to the loudest voice, responding to the minority often. It's trying to demonstrate leadership which is courageous and bold, even in difficult circumstances. And what Northern Ireland really needs is, of course, it needs good leadership, but perhaps more than anything else, now and in the future, it needs that definition of great leadership. And I would say that it would be a major mistake if people were to say, look, the next 3 years, we've got one election after another. Local and European elections in May, Westminster elections the year after, Stormont elections the year after that. That could be an excuse for politicians to say it's all too difficult. We've got to look over our shoulder in terms of our core supporters. I think that that would be a fundamental mistake. I think if you stand still in Northern Ireland, what will happen is you'll go backwards. And therefore the sense of continued momentum and progress and change in the context not just of HAS, but in the context of economic and social progress is really, really important. And I still think that most voters, if you like, the silent majority, will reward those politicians who show that village and show that vision and show that courage. What else have I learnt? Well, final thing, really, is the importance of the engagement of the two governments. I'm absolutely delighted that the Taoiseach is here today, which sends out a very strong signal of his engagement with the political process in Northern Ireland. But, you know, if you look at the history of the peace process, really, there hasn't been progress without the intense engagement of the two governments, working together of one script, however difficult that might have been from time to time, supporting the political parties in Northern Ireland to do the right thing. Now, that doesn't mean taking over. It doesn't mean assuming the responsibilities that appropriately belong with the leaders here in Northern Ireland. But it does mean being alongside those leaders and offering the kind of support and reinforcement that is absolutely crucial. And I think that that engagement is really important, and I've made that point repeatedly since I had this job to my own government. So, conference, I want to end by saying this. In the years ahead, I intend to continue to engage in an extensive way with people across Northern Ireland to understand how an incoming Labour government can make the most difference to supporting the vision of a shared future, which over the next decade needs to be transformed. This has been a theme of today, transformed from rhetoric, which it largely is at the moment, into reality. And in due course, in advance of the 2015 elections, we will lay out our vision for a prosperous and fairer Northern Ireland. Of course, we will respect that most decisions are rightly devolved. But I still think whether it's about jobs and growth, whether it's about welfare policy, whether it's about sharing best practice in terms of educational attainment for the lowest achievers, there is a lot that we can do together. Thank you very much, conference.